Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Co-Chair Heintzman, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and I would move the minutes for March 20th to be approved.
March 20th or 25th?
Excuse me, March 25th.
Thank you. Co-Chair Heintzman moves the minutes for March 25th, 2025. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, today we've got a rather full of agenda, so I'd like to get us moving along today. At certain points when we've got testifiers in the future, as we move along, we'll probably have some time limits potentially to make sure that we stay on target today. We will be starting off this morning with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency budget overview. My understanding that we will be having Commissioner Kessler from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency starting us off. I do see her online, so I'd like to welcome Commissioner Kessler to the committee. If you'd like to go ahead, introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Fisher. Just testing that you can hear me okay.
We can hear you loud and clear. Thank you, Commissioner.
Great. Good to see you all again, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Katrina Kessler, Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Along with me today is Government Relations Director Tom Johnson in the room and Assistant Commissioner Frank Polash, as well as others from our legislative team. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. We're happy to present the governor's budget proposal. I sincerely wish that I could be there in person. I'm actually in Washington, D.C., meeting with colleagues from across all 50 states as part of the annual meeting of the Environmental Council of States. I was able to lead a panel this week with others from Wyoming and Colorado and tech experts on how to use AI and incorporate those into our regular regulatory structure. So learning from others, and I also had critical meetings with the appropriation leads from both parties in the House and the Senate who work on the EPA's budget, which much of which gets passed through to states to carry out those delegated authorities. So really important to be able to have the time here to advocate for resources from the federal government for the state. And I'm going to stay with you and help answer questions, but in the sake of efficiency, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Johnson, who will give the bulk of the presentation because he's in the room and I want to avoid as many tech snafus as possible. So thanks again for the time this afternoon.
Thank you, Commissioner, and we will be definitely back with you with some questions after we have the presentation. Director Tom Johnson, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just making sure I'm hoping that's the present button. Can't see very well.
There we go.
Thank you all. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to walk through the governor's recommendations today for the MPCA. We'll try to keep it brief today. I know it's a full agenda, but really appreciate the opportunity to walk through all of these priorities. We start really with our mission. All of our budget priorities are rooted in our mission to protect and improve the environment and human health. I also want to emphasize that based on this core mission and the One Minnesota goals, the agency recently invested a significant amount of time and effort on a comprehensive strategic plan that has informed each of the proposals you'll see today. We're going to spend most of the time today walking through four proposals that represent the highest priority for the commissioner and for the administration. First of which you'll see, of course, and the commissioner talked about how important core funding is to the agency. Certainly there's a federal component, but the bulk of our funding is from the state. And so an operating adjustment will be important to cover negotiated salary increases and inflationary pressures. Second, permitting efficiency remains a point of focus at the legislature and with key partners who work across the state in many different capacities. Beyond that, it's our belief that being more efficient with our work does result in better environmental outcomes. Updated permits contain more modern strategies for curbing pollution, as well as fostering economic opportunity. Next, you'll see sustainable aviation fuel. This presents an opportunity to bring vibrant new industry to our state and support our climate goals. Additional funding is needed to provide regulatory support for constructing and operating SAF facilities in Minnesota. And then finally, e-waste and battery product stewardship. This is critical to keeping our landfills safe, eliminating a potential environmental risk of battery fires that we've seen, as well as recovering critical minerals needed to move our state towards its climate goals. So, as mentioned, the top priority of the commissioner and the agency this year is funding our agency's core work. This is a simple proposal, but is so critical to the work of preventing pollution, permitting for businesses, remediation, cleanup activities, scientific analysis, all the many, many things the agency does on a daily basis. This allows us to do routine work that Minnesotans expect of us, work that protects the environment and human health and that supports an efficient regulatory environment for Minnesota's business economy. This is just a quick look of more detail into the operating adjustment. The second of the two proposals that fits within this bucket is the air appropriation increase. This is simply routing funds that have already been collected through air fees. Federal, state, and state law require air fees to be set at a level that covers the cost of the program. And this is just appropriating out those funds to the agency. The permitting efficiency proposal is a package of policy and budget ideas. You'll see Chair Fisher's House File 1208 today as well. That is also the agency's policy-only proposal that fits within this package. Together, this work demonstrates the agency and the administration have heard the call for more certainty and accountability while also focusing on solutions that we believe will help. We don't always want to ask for more FTEs, but that is a part of the challenge. When the agency is tasked with additional engagement and wants to provide more technical assistance and also move faster, part of the solution needs to be more staff. And that's why this proposal is for a SWAT team of sorts to work on backlogged permits and ensure that we're moving the needle on the oldest permits at the agency. We're also looking for one-time dollars to fund a study on and pilot the capability of AI to make our work quicker. The commissioner mentioned that work is of interest across the nation and across the state. Whether it's evaluating large data sets in air modeling or effluent limit calculations, or even taking the first crack at the very most simple permits, this could be a game changer, and we want to be an early adopter if it's possible. There are also items in here that are directly responsive to the Chamber Foundation report, such as the permitting ombudsperson, which has been a suggestion for many years and also shows up in Chair Heintzman's House File 8. Finally, the package includes some policy solutions aimed at addressing responsiveness and effectiveness in our back-and-forth interactions with regulated parties and their consultants. One of the problems we encounter is incomplete applications and prolonged back-and-forth with consultants that stretches out the permitting process, sometimes for many weeks or months. We want to incentivize and recognize the work of consultants who consistently produce a quality work and timely work. At the same time, we want to have modest regulatory tools to identify and address cases where the agency is not receiving timely responses from permit applicants or their consultants. So the intent is not to be punitive or burdensome, but rather to encourage consultants and permittees to work in good faith with us towards timely issuance of permits. So again, you'll see details here, 6 FTEs to address the permitting backlog, an ombudsperson, study and pilot to explore AI, and then the mechanisms, both the carrot of a credentialing program for consultants and the stick, as it were, of a mild citation authority for those when we do not receive a timely response. Ramping up production of sustainable aviation fuel represents a time-sensitive and rare opportunity for a public-private partnership to advance our climate goals and to decarbonize the transportation sector and support farmers and employment opportunities in Minnesota. There is significant interest in next-generation low-carbon fuels and fuel intermediaries for aviation. Minnesota has many key attributes that make our state a desirable place to invest in SAF production, such as exceptional agriculture productivity and biomass availability, existing biofuel refineries and transportation infrastructure, and also the demand. To truly take advantage of the opportunity, the MPCA needs additional resources to ensure there is capacity within our regulatory programs to get facilities their required permits and support efficient environmental review of a complex industry. So the proposal in detail is four FTEs working on permitting, and one of these is environmental review of this new industry, including one permitting liaison, so we can support production in a responsible manner. Final of the highest priority issues is e-waste and battery product stewardship, and this addresses the problem of a rapidly growing waste stream of electronics and batteries. This stewardship program will prevent electronics and other electrical products containing embedded batteries from ending up in our landfills. When not managed properly, embedded batteries and electronics produce risks to public safety, human health, and the environment due to fire or toxicity risk. We're also mindful of how this recycling proposal also helps move the needle on recovery of critical minerals and other materials needed to continue renewable energy development. This is a revenue-neutral proposal, and I will just note this slide has not yet been updated for the revised budget, where we're moving out the implementation date 1 year. So this would still be revenue neutral, but move out to FY27. The next proposal will expand MPCA's ability to reduce or eliminate the use of mercury-containing skin lightening creams through outreach, product testing, lab analysis, and local and online sales ban enforcement. This is already illegal in Minnesota, but we know that these products are still used and sold in our state, and more action is needed. Wasted food management. Food puts pressure on our landfills and is a significant source of methane emissions. More importantly, we know that there are higher value uses for much of this wasted food, including, of course, opportunities to redirect perfectly usable food to people who struggle with food insecurity, but also to organics, diverting away from organics, and also use in agriculture for cattle feed. This proposal also complements federal funding from the US EPA's Climate Pollution Reduction Grant Program, which will expand state grant and loan programming for implementing and enhancing wasted food management initiatives. This proposal is focused, the site assessment backlog is focused on eliminating the backlog of high priority Superfund site assessment sites. Sites with suspected hazardous waste releases are triaged in the MPCA site assessment program, with priority given to sites with the greatest risk to human health and the environment, which are prioritized first for assessment and cleanup. Currently, the rate of sites coming into the program far exceeds the amount that can be completed in a given year. So this proposal projects to reduce the high priority backlog to 90 sites by 2029 and allow for transition to the medium and low priority backlog sites. With the increase in discovery of new contaminants, including 1,4-dioxane and, of course, PFAS, the MPCA has seen a considerable increase in the number of sites, and this includes issues such as vapor intrusion into buildings and contaminated drinking water. So this is two FTEs. Recognizing the budget situation that the state finds itself in, we have two cost-saving proposals that we have proposed this year. The first addresses MPCA's authority to recover costs for the agency's response to spills and releases of materials that do not fall under existing cost recovery statutes. We respond to various spills of materials to the environment and work to ensure the responsible party responds appropriately to address the contamination. But when that responsible party is unwilling or unable to take the necessary actions, MPCA hires a contractor to do the work, and with this proposal would be able to recover its expenses from the responsible party afterwards. The second proposal we talked about a little bit the other day with Representative Burkle's bill to maintain the current level of funding for the county feedlot program. This proposal was intended to align with the legislative intent that was expressed and in the committee in the conference committee spreadsheet agreement, which was for that increase to be one time. But we do, as I said, as the agency said in testimony previously, we do very much value the work of our county feedlot officers and their partnership. The final bucket here is really low cost, no cost, and technical change items. The MPCA is expecting $17 million in federal funding available for the term of the IIJA, the bipartisan infrastructure law, to be distributed for PFAS planning, pilot testing, design, or treatment projects at publicly owned treatment works. And so that is the first item, accessing federal funds for PFAS treatment. Small tweaks are needed to those statutes. The revolving loan fund item corrects an omission from the 2023 session law to specify that loan repayments for two existing programs should be deposited back into the associated revolving loan accounts. The technical change item is just realigning appropriations for the MPCA to better reflect the current organizational structure. There's no increase or decrease of funding, but aligns funding and FTE to the proper division for transparency and accuracy. The PFAS biomonitoring and firefighters item utilizes unspent funds for this project and allows us to transfer the rest of that funding over to the Department of Health, which they could use to meet those biomonitoring requirements. And then finally, opening a statutory appropriation beginning in fiscal year 2026 from the Closed Landfill Investment Fund to the Remediation Division of the MPCA to provide for the state's long-term care and maintenance of closed landfills statewide. That concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the time. I will switch back to the Zoom for questions for myself and the commissioner.
Thank you, Director Johnson. The first person I've got on the list is Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Johnson. I have a couple questions about air quality monitors, and just if you could give an update about purchase and implementation of the air quality monitors from last year, and then following that, I have a couple other questions.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we have with us Assistant Commissioner Frank Kolash to answer some of the air quality questions.
Super. Assistant Commissioner, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Frank Kolash. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. To your question, Representative Hansen, about the five air toxics monitors that were funded in the 2024 session, we are very close to deploying a number of those. We have been engaging with community, engaging with our Environmental Justice Advisory Group to make sure that we are citing those within the constraints of what both the legislature wanted, but what also makes sense to make sure that the information is providing useful data to the communities. So for the site that we will add, the monitor we will add to the Northern Iron site, we have a lease signed, and we intend to start collecting samples next week. For the North Minneapolis site, we are going to locate that on the Minneapolis Public School plant and maintenance operations. We are finalizing that lease as well with the city of Minneapolis. We are looking at a May 2025 start date for that monitor. With Rochester, we have the lease completed with the Fulwell School, and again, a May 2025 start time for that monitor to begin as well. With Newport, we also have the lease completed with the city of Newport to be located on their city hall. And again, looking for a May to June startup. We just need to work out the details with the building owners and make sure we can get the electricity drop ready to go. And then for St. Paul Brass, the Frogtown Park and Farm, we've agreed to host the site. We're working on the lease for them as well to have access to those sites. So by this summer, we should be having all or nearly all of the sites up and running and providing data to us on a regular basis.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and follow up on the odor rulemaking, if you could give us an update on what's happening with that.
Director Johnson, or will that be Assistant Director?
I can start, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned to the committee during the agency's overview, the odor rulemaking is in process. We have four different air quality rulemakings occurring right now. The highest priority had to be the cumulative impacts air and both the air toxics rulemakings because they have a legislatively mandated deadline of May of 2026. So we have continued to move that odor rulemaking forward, but it has not had the accelerated timeline that the other rulemakings have had. So we've had an initial request for comment put out. We also did additional work with other states to learn about their odor regulations. And then we now are in the phase of working through some of that rule text or considering other options.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one final question. It's my understanding that at the federal level, they have redefined sustainable aviation fuel as synthetic aviation fuel. And so I'm just wondering what the PCA's response to that is and how verifying actual sustainability if the federal government is calling it synthetic.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Kolash.
Assistant Commissioner.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen. Yes, we understand that the EPA and the federal government has changed the naming. However, we don't see that is an effective use, and we're not going to be following that kind of definition. What we are going to be following is the definition of sustainable aviation fuel, which is in the tax credit, which defines that sustainable aviation fuel must have a carbon intensity of at least 50% less than what a fossil aviation fuel would be. We're also looking at the entirety of the production of sustainable aviation fuel from the multiple feedstocks that can go in with that. Those feedstocks then also have potential environmental consequences and concerns that we have regarding those as well. We're looking at that across the climate subcabinet, seven different agencies working on a regular basis to make sure that we understand that we have a good understanding of what's happening from the feedstocks, what's needed to make those feedstocks, what's needed to get those feedstocks to a place where the sustainable aviation fuel is made, making sure we understand what's happening at the place where the sustainable aviation fuel is produced, and then how is the sustainable aviation fuel being moved off-site to where it needs to be used, as well as those other products that are going to be produced from the process. So we are looking at it from a truly sustainable side. We're not going to be sacrificing air quality, water quantity, groundwater quality, soil health, or any other environmental components that are important to Minnesotans just for the carbon intensity reduction. We do look at it as a sustainable aviation fuel.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if in those assessments that you find that there are water quality impacts, air quality impacts with the production, then will the PCA cease promoting synthetic aviation fuel?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, what we will be looking at is the entirety of the potential environmental impacts. And if there are impacts, we're going to be looking at the various types of feedstocks and looking for ways that we can move forward with the least environmentally impacting feedstocks, because we do understand that each of the feedstocks has a different pathway to get there, and there are various opportunities that Minnesota has, depending also with our resources around green electricity and clean electricity and using that in the most effective way, and we'll be continuing to make sure that it is sustainable in the broadest form of the word.
All right. Next, I'm going to be going to Chair Heintzman. After that, I've got Representative Gilman and Representative Jordan. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I have a couple of questions on your presentation, and then I also have a question about an email the committee received about 25 minutes before we actually convened today. And I'm going to start with the permitting reform page in your presentation. And a reference that was made to the permitting reform bill that I'm carrying. The reference specifically is referring to the ombudsman that has been discussed in committee here and then continues to be discussed, and it sounded like that position was something that you mentioned was in my bill. And I just wanted to confirm that the proposal is that the ombudsman would be at deed, or if you're still proposing that it be held at MPCA.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Heintzman. We, in the governor's proposal, the ombudsperson would be at MPCA, and so you're right that there's not a direct exact correlation, but we feel the concept is there in both pieces of legislation, and so we're happy to that there's some alignment there in concept.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification, Director. I just thought maybe we were starting to maybe see some progress on items where there has been some differences, and I will just continue to hope that we can move towards something at deed as opposed to MPCA. I think that makes a lot of sense. There was some discussion about that earlier, and I'll look forward to future conversations as it appears there may be a better prospect of meaningful permitting reform in Minnesota. I think Minnesotans that are trying to get through these processes have felt as though they're starting to be heard, and I don't want that to be lost. And one of the things that they specifically asked for is that that position be held at deed. Another clarification is this email that I mentioned earlier. We all know that we're facing quite a challenge in the coming years as we have a looming $6 billion deficit. We've known there's been a deficit for well over a year, and when DNR was here on Tuesday, there was a discussion about what is happening there to try to prepare for that. But today I just wanted to look at this because I see in this email that we just received a little bit ago, and I apologize to members because I can't distribute it. It was late in coming to the committee. So I'm just going to reference it quickly. There's a interesting way of describing some of the grants. Usually we hear a discussion around grants as dollars that are encumbered or expended. And in this particular email, there's some lingo here that I'm really not familiar with. And it's hard for me to understand, and maybe offline there can be discussion with members since we can't really look at the document today, but whether these dollars are expended or encumbered in your budget as we're trying to find savings, as we're dealing with this potential deficit that we know is coming. Could you help the committee maybe understand a little bit better when they do get a chance to look at this, what you mean by awarded, reviewed, appropriated from dollars appropriated in 23.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Heintzman, I think the we know that this is the largest appropriation that the agency has frankly ever received from the state. And so we know there was interest, and I think the desire was to send something ahead of committee to make sure that you all were seeing a little bit more detail on, and I know the email, which we will make sure all members have access to, that there was charts in there showing each of the different rounds of RFP and where they are at, the some are closed, some of the funds have already been awarded, and the funds are actually outside the agency and so completely expended. There's been an award made, a grant contract signed, so the funds are encumbered, and then there's this other bucket which Mr. Chair or Chair Heintzman, you're referring to, and I think this is where we're trying to show to the committee where we have already put out an RFP. The RFPs have all closed for all of the funds in the Resilient Communities Grants. We are in the process of, or have already awarded and notified the awardees that they are receiving the funds, but there is not a grant contract signed yet. So those funds, technically, yes, the committee could rescind those funds and use them for another opportunity, but I think where we're trying to get at is this would literally be, we have already notified these awardees that they will be receiving funds through this program, and while the funding is technically available and not spent, that would be a difficult thing to do for those awardees.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the benefit of the committee and for those watching today, the grants are specifically from the Resiliency Community Grants, or appropriated in 2023. I should have specifically mentioned that. Mostly, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that folks were aware of this document, and that if they wanted to take a look at it, that even though it wasn't necessarily available in a timely way for the committee today, that it is relevant information that probably needed to be discussed and on the record. I may have questions later, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Next, I'll go to Representative Gilman, then Representative Jordan, and then I know we're going to try to wrap up within the next 10 to 12 minutes here.
Thank you, Chair Fisher.
Go ahead, Representative Gilman. Thank you.
Thank you. My question is for you, Director, or the Commissioner. So again, as we're talking about the deficit coming up here, have you done anything internally to try to figure out how to reduce your expenditures by 10%, 5, 10%? What have you done internally to look at that?
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, Representative Gilman, we did an exercise related to the general fund with MMB. And this was a 5% reduction increase, and the items that you see within the governor's budget recommendations do represent more than a 5% increase or a decrease in the MPCA's general fund spending. The MPCA has $17.5 million of ongoing base general fund spending. Barely any of our budget comes from the general fund, and so the reduction exercise was not easy because there's so few things, but represents a relatively small amount overall compared to the overall deficit amount that we're seeing.
Representative Gilman.
Great. So, and one quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
My other question is about just people coming back to work. We've talked about that, and I think the last time you were here, you mentioned that your office space was currently being leased out by someone else. So now with folks coming back to work this summer, 50% of the time at least, do you think that's going to impact your budget?
Director Johnson.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Gilman, that's an excellent question. Obviously, you know, the announcement was very recent, and so we're still working through some of the details. I think there have been some opportunities we've identified right away where we were maybe in the course of working through a lease agreement with another agency that maybe we're going to pause for now while we reassess. So there are certainly areas where we're already trying to adjust. With 50% being the target, there is opportunity for individuals to share workstations, and so I think that's probably where we're going to start at. And so we don't foresee an initial significant budget impact at this time. However, yes, as we will be paying more money in rent if we have to pull back the subleases that we've already entered into with other state agencies.
Okay, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, and I just, yeah, I'll follow up with that. Just saying, I'm excited to see people do better when we're together working, and I'm excited to see some things change in the future with that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Jardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have questions about permitting reform. You know, on this handout, you say that permitting reform will be good for the process for businesses and local business and local government, but I have some questions about how permitting reform is going to impact people, especially people who live in environmental justice areas. I think it's just kind of unquestionable that the current permitting reform failed people in East Phillips with the Smith Foundry. It took the EPA coming in to say there was a problem here. So I'm just wondering what changes, and we talked about this last time we were up here, but I'm just wondering, and it would be great if Commissioner Kessler could weigh in on this, what changes have you made in your permitting for environmental justice areas as a result of the EPA uncovering the emissions that were happening and the permit violations that were happening with Smith Foundry?
I'll start with Director Johnson and then go to Commissioner. Okay. Or go ahead, Commissioner.
Yeah,
okay.
Chair Fisher, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
I didn't want to interrupt your flow, but I appreciate Representative Jordan's question, and thank you both. So I agree that that is an important process improvement effort that the agency has been underway, so thanks for asking the question. And I also just want to take the opportunity to say thank you to the legislature for the additional resources that the agency has been given around air monitoring. We talked a little bit about this in response to Representative Hansen's questions about citing air monitors. In addition to air monitoring at stationary locations, one of the things that the agency asked for and the legislature provided was money to build and implement a mobile monitoring trailer so that some of the barriers that you heard Assistant Commissioner Kolesh talk about in terms of getting a lease agreement signed and getting power to a location that can provide continuity in terms of air monitoring, we can skip those hurdles and have a more nimble response when we need to have air monitoring immediately in terms of compliance around a facility. We are really happy with the new staff at the agency around community engagement, which have made it possible for us to be more present in communities where historically there have been disproportionate impacts and we have older permits that we need to address. And I agree with Representative Jordan that permitting reform doesn't just work for businesses, it needs to work for people. And addressing backlog permits, older permits that have not, frankly, been touched in too long is necessary in order to bring our environmental protections up to 2025 standards, and additional staff that have been provided to community affairs allows us to begin that work. And the proposal that you heard Director Johnson talk about will bring additional resources to that work. We also are working very closely with EPA to make sure that where they are showing up for enforcement and inspections, we are showing up in tandem so that we understand what they are doing and collecting data alongside them so that there are no surprises or miscommunications along the way. We're trying to make data more transparently available. For example, in East Phillips, we have a 24/7 monitor that is across the street so people can, from the Smith Foundry location, so people can see the air, the particulate monitor levels that are being monitored continuously in that location. And just making sure that we are responsive when people are asking questions, and the additional resources, again, with support from the legislature, with it, whether it's monitoring or community affairs, have been really instrumental in that.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Kessler. Kind of as a follow-up to that, the Smith Foundry permit had been in process of being analyzed for, I think, a number of years, I think around seven, feel free to correct that if that's wrong, when the EPA visited and uncovered what was happening and the failures in our permitting system. So what other permits, particularly in environmental justice areas, have been under review for five plus years, and how would, if this permitting reform goes into effect and this money, how would that affect that permitting process for those permits that have been under review for so long?
Commissioner Kessler.
Chair Fisher and Representative Jordan, thank you again for the question. I don't have a list of all of those permits in front of me, but I will call out one process improvement the agency has brought online in the last several months is a permitting dashboard. And we can make sure that all of you have a link to that so you can go in and look at any particular facility's permit that has been submitted within the last 5 years and where it is in the process. And I will say one of the things that we did in response to learnings around the Smith boundary was looking at facilities in environmental justice neighborhoods where we needed to do inspections, where they had expired permits, and we at least shifted priorities for that particular year to make sure that we could provide inspections in at least all of those on that list. And Assistant Commissioner Kolesh may remember how many it was, but it was, you know, between 60 and 100 facilities in Hennepin County and Ramsey County that we visited to make sure that we at least had been there and could talk about where they were in terms of compliance, and then prioritizing the permitting queue along the way. So we can follow up with a more like specific detailed response to Representative Jordan's questions about how many are more than 5 years old. But I do think permitting backlogs is a priority both from a regulated party standpoint in terms of maybe they want to do construction or provide additional economic investment. But it's critically an important priority for us in terms of making sure that we are holding people to the environmental standards that we have around human health and the environment in this day and age.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had that part two of that question too. Sorry, I know it was a long one, about what changes the MPCA is seeking would do to those permits. Would that help you speed up holding corporate polluters accountable? Would it help speed up public engagement processes? How does it, or does it do the opposite of that? So what is the effect of your permitting proposals on these permits that we're talking about here?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Commissioner Kessler.
Sure. Chair Fisher, yeah, Representative Byrd, thank you for the reminder of the second half of the question. So specifically permits that are on the backlog are a target of what Director Johnson talked about. We want to make sure that those permits that are on the backlog that have been in-house, permit applications in-house for a number of years in some instances are, you're able to get those off the books, get them modernized, get responses in a way that we get data that is representative of what's going on. And so that is a specific target of what we are asking for as a part of this proposal. Hopefully that answers the question.
Representative Jordan, final question.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do hope that, you know, we're, that when we talk about permitting reform, we're not just talking about making it easier to build a copper mine or a shingle factory or a foundry. We're talking about how we can protect people's health. You know, asthma is a real thing that you know, prevents children from being in school. We talk a lot about, you know, in my committee in education policy, we talk a lot about absences and what the effect of missing one day of school has. Well, one of the number one reasons that kids in Minneapolis public schools miss school is because of asthma. They're in the hospital because they can't breathe. And that's because the air that they breathe is making them sick. And I'm one of those people who has had to miss work because I've been in the hospital with my own asthma. So I hope this is something that we're thinking about, too. I mean, it's nice that we're trying to make things easier for businesses, but we really need to be focused on people's health and the water they drink and the air they breathe. So I hope that's part of the conversation as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. I've got one final question for the commissioner. Commissioner Kessler, thank you for being here. The final question I have is one of the concerns I've had, we've heard about Smith Foundry. We also know that we've had the same issue with Northern Iron over in St. Paul, where these issues were originally found by the EPA. Given what is happening at the federal level and the fact that it seems the EPA is not going to be doing the work they did before, what are the plans for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency going forward to try to help cover the inspections that the EPA did? What are we going to do to be more robust in that area?
Yeah, Chair Fisher, thank you for the question. Certainly, changes at the federal level do impact us both from a pass-through dollars that we started with at the top of the committee, but also in a partnership in staff and in a partnership in establishing the really important science that underlays the standards that are enforced across the nation, hopefully consistently. And one thing I'll point to is, you know, we're again grateful to the legislature for additional resources for inspectors and air permitting staff that we brought on board after the Smith Boundary with the support for the legislature to work in environmental justice community. So we hired additional permit writers and inspectors to target in those areas. Whether or not we have enough resources to fill any holes that might be that might last because of the firing of all the environmental justice staff at the US EPA. I can't speak whether it's one to one, but we're going to do our best to make sure that we're showing up where there are disproportionate impacts and addressing permits that are backlogged, because it's important, as Representative Jordan has pointed out, for human health.
Thank you, Commissioner. We'll look forward to continued discussions on this going forward. Thank you, Director Johnson, for being here. Assistant Commissioner, thank you for being here. And with that, we will move on to our first bill of the day. That's going to be House File 1587. Representative Stevenson, if you'd like to come forward, please. Seeing you're not on the committee, I will move that House File 1587 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Stevenson, to your bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I know you are short on time today, so I will be very brief. Members, this bill transfers some land in northern Minnesota from the state to the Leech Lake tribe. They are here with us today. Leaders from Leech Lake are here today to discuss the proposal in greater detail. This is some trust land that is not accessible. There's no road that goes there, but it is connected to existing Leech Lake property, which they could put to better use. So I'll turn it over this time, Mr. Chair, to tribal leaders who have joined us today.
Okay. Thank you for our tribal leaders being here today. I believe District Representative Stephen White. If you'd like to go first, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
District Representative Steve White from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Thank you, chairs and committee members, for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1587. My name is Steve White. I serve as a District 2 representative for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I represent the area of Leech Lake Reservation, which includes the state-owned parcels that House File 1587 would help transfer back to the band. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has been working with the Minnesota DNR for almost a decade to make this transfer happen. Today, I am pleased to share that both the DNR and the Office of School Trust support the proposal. I want to thank both the DNR and OSTL for their support and their hard work in this process over many years. I also want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward today. The small transfer of land from our state government to our tribal government is a unique opportunity to enhance the use of the parcel in the way that benefits my community in Bena, both for tribal members and non-tribal members. The parcel involved is across the parking lot from our existing Bena Community Center, as shown in the photos in our handouts. Through the trees of the community center, you can see Lake Waitibogoshes just 300 feet away. There is also a sandy beach and shallow water. It's a perfect spot for families and children to have lake access year-round. However, with this thin strip of land between the band's community center and the lake is currently owned by the state, which has prevented the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe from making improvements to the beach for public use. The bill before you today would help support and solve this problem. Speaking on behalf of the Leech Lake Tribal Government, our vision is to develop this site as an extension of the community center and to improve the beach area for community use. This would become the only public beach on Lake Waitibogoshes in Bena. In every way, it would be a better use of the land and a win for the community. Chief Miigwech, for your time and attention, I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, District Representative. And next I have Secretary Treasurer Finde, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Finde.
Yeah. Thank you. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lenny Finde. I have the honor of serving the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe as Secretary Treasurer. And I want to thank you for taking time today. I know you have a packed schedule. I don't want to repeat anything that Representative White shared with the committee, but I do just have some additional information that I'd like to share. We have been working on this with the DNR for a number of years, and we're very pleased to have the support of the School Trust Lands Division within the Department of Resource Management. And even though I am here to testify today as Secretary Treasurer of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, on a personal level, I want to let every member of the committee know that I also have the privilege and honor of serving as an elected member of the Cass Lake Bena School Board, School District 115. And on a related note, I'll note that School District 115 has has conveyed to members of the legislature their support for this legislation as well, as this land is located within Castlake Bena School District. I also, on that point, want to note my personal how much I appreciate the Permanent School Trust Fund and school trust lands and the system that we have in Minnesota and how that benefits my role as an elected member of the Castlake Bena School Board. However, what we're talking about today with this 13.59 acres within the Bena community in the heart of the Leech Lake Reservation, the land is currently not usable. It's not accessible. The only income that it has generated has been from a small lease from the Leech Lake Band to the Minnesota DNR. And really what this legislation does is it opens up some previously unusable land for a solid community public purpose in allowing us to create a beach and recreation area and community green space for a community that sorely needs it. And it's not just going to be green space for tribal members or native members of the Bena community, but it's going to be public access. And that's the vision behind it, and that's the reason behind, I believe that's the reason also behind the support that we have from DNR on this transfer as well. We believe that this legislation represents a win-win. In closing, I just want to note some statistics about the Leech Lake Reservation. The Leech Lake Reservation was established by the Treaty of 1855. The Treaty of 1855 and subsequent executive orders guaranteed a homeland for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe at 622,300 acres. 622,300 acres. That was in 1855. Currently today, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has in tribal trust status 45,753 acres, or 7.35% of our treaty guaranteed homelands. Meanwhile, school trust lands within the boundaries of the Leech Lake Reservation are 142,274 acres, or 22% of our treaty guaranteed homelands. There are far more school trust parcels within the boundaries of the reservation than there are tribal trust parcels within the boundaries of our reservation. And so we feel that this small exchange is a win-win because it benefits the community, it benefits the reservation, and it benefits the state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Secretary Treasurer. Next on the testifier list, I have Mr. Lindy from the Office of the School Trusts. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher, members. Aaron Vandalin, School Trust Lands Director, and I will not belabor a lot of the context that's already been provided. They've said this is a school trust parcel that does not have access. That limits its ability for any kind of management, let alone a public auction, is usually how we handle these situations. This bill is in the best interest of the school trust. It will generate revenue for the trust, and it does meet the goal of the permanent school fund because it's done with sound natural resource and conservation management principles in that the recipient of this land will be the reservation, or excuse me, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I have nothing further unless there's questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the public who'd like to speak on this bill? Not seeing any, the testimony is closed. We will go to questions. I have Representative Heintzman and the Representative Schultz. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question for DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for DNR, but as DNR is coming up, I'm just wondering if Representative Stevenson could tell us if we know how this encroachment actually happened onto school trust land.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heintzman, Chair Heintzman, I do know in the materials it says that the encroachment was unintentional. I would ask if Secretary Treasurer Finde or Representative White might have more history about how that happened.
Secretary Treasurer Finde.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Heintzman, I don't have any specifics on how that happened other than we constructed our new Bena Community Center, and from our land records at the time, it was land that we believed we owned, and it wasn't until later on when we wanted to actually construct the beach that we learned that this was school trust land in consultation with the DNR, and that's what started this whole process. But also what started this, we did enter into a lease agreement. What I do want to note, that encroachment that's there is actually our early childhood center that has a Head Start and a playground. So that's what's encroaching on the unusable school trust land right now.
Do you want to go to the DNR? Assistant Commissioner Meyer, if you'd like to introduce yourself and go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Assistant Commissioner. If you could, for the committee, could you please kind of walk through what normally, what is the process when there is an encroachment on school trust land and who usually pays and how that works, if you could?
Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Heintzman. Yes, and it's important to note these encroachments happen on non-trust land as well, on acquired lands, other lands. I'm sure it happens on county lands as well. What the process that we follow, and we've done this in several times in other members' districts, is we identify that encroachment. Sometimes it's brought to us by a neighbor, or sometimes a person trying to sell their land will do a survey, and then an encroachment is identified, either a building, septic systems we've had in the past, things like that. So as Secretary Treasurer Findate identified, we did identify the encroachment. We valued it. We surveyed it. We did an appraisal, I mean, by valued it. And then we developed a lease. So anytime we have these issues, we first identify the encroachment, do a survey of it, do an appraisal of what that encroachment is worth. And then if it's acquired lands, oftentimes we can work into a directed sale with the approval of the legislature or to that adjacent landowner or to the landowner who created the encroachment. Or in the case of trust fund lands, there are other proceedings that need to take place. So you need to appraise the land and the improvements on that land, and then do a condemnation proceeding, which is what we're recommending here. And then that land would be offered at public sale because trust lands need to be offered at public sale. We have followed these procedures. We did identify the encroachment. We have a lease with the Leech Lake Band, and we did meet with them several times and visited the property, actually, and identified several other options on exchange, direct condemnation and sale with legislative approval, and that what brings us here today, Mr. Chairman. So there are different options. Most times when it's on acquired lands, we work and try to do a directed sale to those landowners, but when it is on trust land, we would have to do a public auction without specific legislative direction. I should note that during that auction and the appraisal process, we value the improvements made on the land. So if a person has a garage or a septic system, that would be added to the price of that public sale so that people don't go buy somebody's land, I mean, septic system and things like that. So try to make sure that if at all possible, the adjoining landowner can have access to that land.
Chair Heintzman.
Final question I had, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I believe I heard Assistant Commissioner, that if this were a private citizen, that those that have encroached, on school trust lands, they personally would pay, not the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Here, Representative Heintzman. Yes, unless they were to bring a bill from their representative or senator to the legislature.
Okay. Nothing further.
I think, Mr. Chairman, just it's really important to realize this land has no access as well, as was discussed on the record. So that's what brought us to this conversation in support of work with the Leech Lake Band on this process.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Schultz, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know the particulars of this, you know, given instance beyond what I've heard today. I'll just share that, you know, this is similar to a situation that happened, or I should say a similar bill to one that impacted a county in my own district last session. And at that time, it appeared like there wasn't any consultation with my local county officers. And I wanted to see if there is a perspective that is shared by the local county, Cass County, on this particular bill.
Secretary Treasurer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz. I can say that at Leech Lake, we have a very solid relationship with Cass County. We have a MOU. We do annual consultation between the Leech Lake Tribal Council and the Cass County Board of Commissioners. We have not gotten a position from Cass County on this particular legislation, but they're aware that we're working on it. And I would go back earlier to my earlier testimony about the local school district being in support of this. I do also want to note that from our perspective as the tribe, this is not something that we have attempted to do in any type of closed-door fashion. We have had meetings with our local representative, Representative Bliss, as well as our local senator, Senator Green, on this issue. I know that we're continuing to work with them. We're continuing to work with the school district and with the county as well. This isn't something that we're trying to be do anything behind any closed doors or secret deals or anything like that, but we are again, as I said in my testimony, we really believe that this truly is a win-win for the county, for the state, for the tribe as well, for the local community as a whole.
Representative Schultz, final question.
Yes, thank you. And Secretary Fine, I appreciate the fact that you have engaged, and please continue to do so as this bill moves through the process. That's certainly helpful for everybody involved. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Stevenson, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing the bill. I hope you consider it as you assemble your finance package.
I renew my motion that House File 1587 be laid over for possible inclusion in the future. The bill is laid over. Our next bill on the agenda today is House File 2293. Representative Hollins, if you'd like to come forward, while you're coming forward, I will move that House File 2293 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Hollins, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and begin your testimony, or begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. This bill is an appropriation for the Community Grants Program that was established by statute in 2023. The Community Grants Program was the brainchild of a coalition of organizations who saw smaller organizations and municipalities struggling to access LCCMR funds. The LCCMR is a great commission, but it isn't set up to support all of the good eligible projects that are out there. The traditional LCCMR process skews towards supporting large organizations like the U of M or the Sierra Club, and this is true for several reasons, which the Community Grants Program seeks to remedy. First, larger organizations have the resources and time to have dedicated grant writers and lobbyists who advocate for their projects to members of the LCCMR, and I can attest to this because I was a member of the LCCMR, and they do come and lobby you on them. And then second, the traditional LCCMR program works on reimbursement basement, which is incredibly difficult for most smaller organizations to handle. The community grant program seeks to use a small percentage of the LCCMR funds to help smaller nonprofits and municipalities to access some of these funds. The program requires an advisory council to work with and advise the DNR and review funded projects annually. It also requires annual reporting to the legislature and has a clawback provision for unspent funds. I want to note that Co-Chair Heinzman and I spoke about this bill, and we are continuing to work on it to try to thread the needle on moving forward. But I do have several testifiers, and I would like to welcome them up now.
Certainly. We have, looks like, several testifiers that are here today. I'd like to try to keep testimony to no longer than a minute and a half. The first person I have is Mike Harley.
DNR. Oh, sorry.
Oops, DNR.
Can we have the folks from the DNR speak first?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Could I have the DNR step forward? Thank you for being here today. If you could please introduce yourself and then begin your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Fisher, Chair Heinzman, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Sherman-Hohen. I am the agency-wide grants manager for the Department of Natural Resources. And I'm going to talk very briefly about how the DNR does grant making, what we are doing on the community grants program to date, and what we have upcoming. The DNR manages $165 million in grants annually over 50 grant programs. That does include partnering with the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources to oversee pass-through grants from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. All DNR grants are managed in accordance with Minnesota statute, Office of Grants Management Policies and Procedures, and DNR grants policies and, where appropriate, federal laws and policies. The DNR follows all state, federal, and federal policies and laws in the design and implementation of any new grant program, including the Community Grants Program. The DNR has been working to implement the Community Grants Program since it was passed by the legislature in 2023. In the past year, organizations that advocated for the Trust Fund Community Grants Program formed a working group to draft recommendations to the DNR Commissioner on the structure of the Advisory Council, grant opportunities, and outreach that are in statute. Since the election, the DNR has moved from planning to implementation of this program. Currently, we are focusing on Advisory Council creation and selection process. All statutory requirements for members will be met, including experience, geographic spread, and community membership. We're working to ensure that we are ready to implement the program once the funding is appropriated. In designing the program structure, the DNR is focusing on risk control and mitigation measures to prevent fraud and ensure accountability, transparency and ease of application in the granting process for grantees, and support for variation in organizational capacity and potential applicants. We understand the expectations that are placed on this funding, and we have several decades of experience in administering trust fund pass-through grant appropriations as well as other grant programs. The Community Grants Program will build on current DNR best practices in grants management and risk mitigation, which were developed both for the pass-through grants and for our own competitive grant programs. The DNR will continue to consult with the Office of Grants Management and other resources to build this approach. That concludes my testimony, and we can stand for questions.
Thank you. I also had Mary Robinson from Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mary Robinson, CFO for the DNR. I have nothing to add to that testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for the for your testimony. Next, we'll move on to Mike Harley. And then after that will be Cecilia Calvo. Please go ahead and introduce yourself. You'll have a minute and a half.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Fisher and Chair Heinzman. My name is Mike Harley. I'm the Executive Director of Environmental Initiative, which is a nonprofit that builds partnerships between business, communities, government, and nonprofits to tackle environmental challenges. And I'm here to express my organization's support for House File 2293 as the bill that appropriates dollars from the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund into this new community grants program. The environmental initiative work began in the summer of 2021 with rural and urban leaders from all across the state as we got together and thought about how to address some of the barriers that Representative Hollins has mentioned that poses challenges for small organizations, community organizations, rural organizations in accessing Environment Natural Resource Trust Fund dollars. The group that we pulled together included representatives from Red Lake Nation, COPAL, the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships at the University of Minnesota, the Initiative Foundation in Little Falls, Rainbow Research, and many others. I won't repeat the set of barriers that Representative Hollins mentioned. I think we've talked about that enough, but this creative group of folks came together to try to put our heads in a creative way to come up with solutions. We were excited to have the chance to work with the legislature to address those solutions and bring forward the Community Grants Program, which was passed into law in 2023. With voters' overwhelming support in 2024 to renew and expand the trust fund, Minnesotans clearly signaled the desire for public investments that benefit all communities, not just those that have the resources to engage in a legislative process or the capacity to navigate the finances that are involved with reimbursement.
If you could wrap it up, please.
Yep, I appreciate it very much. So I'm excited to be here today and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. Next, Cecilia Calvo, if you'd like to introduce yourself, please, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Heinzman and Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Cecilia Calvo, and I'm the Senior Director of Environmental Research at Rainbow Research, and we are part of the coalition that we've been speaking about. I'm here to speak in support of HF 2293 and to share a bit about why the appropriation to the Community Grants Program is so important and could not come at a better time. We have encountered people in community across the breadth of Minnesota who do not have the financial resources and means to successfully navigate a complex process seeking grant funds. However, many interested people have good ideas and are eager to address environmental challenges in their communities. A community grants program, by ensuring that all Minnesota communities and organizations concerned have a potential resource they can access to contribute to improving environmental access, education, health, stewardship, and quality is a great benefit to all Minnesotans. Minnesotans are ready for a community grants program that will meet the intersection of environmental protection and environmental health, that responds to the needs of communities statewide who are overburdened by pollution, that listens to the solutions they hold to help protect our clean air and water, and that reduces the barriers to accessing these funds. In addition, the Minnesota DNR, working closely with the Community Advisory Council, composed of people who recognize the importance of this funding source from all over the state. The Advisory Council has an important role in working with the DNR to ensure this program is effectively delivering funding and meeting the intent of the statute to expand the number and diversity of recipients who benefit from the NRTF, especially in communities that have been adversely affected by pollution and environmental degradation. And to wrap up, the Advisory Council will help review program structures and recipient eligibility and promote transparency, accessibility, and effectiveness in the allocation of resources. The Advisory Council will also inform the legislature on future improvements to ensure that communities who have not been included can help shape and benefit from environmental funding. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Not seeing any. At this point in time, we'll go to questions from members. First question is coming from Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to start by thanking the bill author for what I consider to be a very productive conversation today. I do have a few questions that I'm just going to put on the record, things that I think we all agree have to be addressed. And I think that I'm saying that, well, I am. I'm saying that in the context of, in order for something like this to move forward and for dollars to start going out, I think we need to know what types of projects we would anticipate being funded with the new grants. I think we need to know what the cap is, if any, on grant size. How will grants be monitored to ensure that there's no fraud? Will there be any other reporting requirements? And I'm not putting that out there as a, we need to have that conversation right now today, Mr. Chair. I'm just putting that out there saying, these are the concerns that that I have and a number of others who have looked at this program as it was proposed in the last biennium. And I think that Representative Hollins and I are in agreement that there's work to be done on this. I'm committed to trying to find a way to address concerns that I think generally most Minnesotans absolutely agree have to be, things like trail maintenance, things like park needs and other ongoing needs that infrastructure is facing. And I introduced a proposal that is sitting on the general register and could potentially be discussed sooner than later, but we do need to work in a bipartisan way to find answers to these questions and to figure out a way to address what I think is very fairly being discussed today as a challenging process at the LCCMR. We tried to get at that with a small community grants or small grants program in the LCCMR. Usually, I think the projects were under $200,000 as a category. We do have the emerging issues account that has a role as well. We put dollars towards RT Quick and the development of that technology. Really important to get at the issue of CWD. So there's some good examples of how we have tried to create a less intensive process. Now, all that being said, it's important that we have guardrails. It's critical that we have tools to avoid the kinds of concerns that could lead to projects getting funded that haven't been fully vetted or that may have down the road issues that could have been easily addressed if it was a more thorough process getting to the point where groups or organizations have funds. So that, Mr. Chair, is where I want to end my comments. My members on this side of the table may have their own, but I did want to just make sure that the public and the committee is aware of, I think, a good opportunity to make sure that what, even though it is a small percentage, as what we heard in the presentation, 1.5% coming out of the trust on top of the current draw, it actually turns out to be a lot of money. Over the course of the coming biennium, $58-plus million, $28 million-plus per year, which when I started on the LCCMR, I think that we were looking at in the neighborhood of $50, $55 million total. I see Representative Hansen shaking his head. I think we both have seen those kinds of numbers. And now the trust has grown from $1 billion to $2 billion, which is great. I think it's an excellent model for how you fund these kinds of things like ongoing costs and such and the research that we talked about earlier. That's a lot to say, Mr. Chair, but I wanted to make sure it was on the record.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Heintzman, also. I agree. I think it was a really productive meeting that we had, and I think what we found when we met was that we have a lot more in common than we might have assumed, and also that we have a lot of values in common and things that we know do need to be funded. And it is truly my goal that it is the smaller organizations in the state of Minnesota who have been, you know, overlooked or not gotten the support that they need that would be able to access these funds. And so I am definitely committed to continuing to work with you to figure out how we can thread the needle and make sure that that money is getting to the people who need it, getting to the parts of the state that need it, and also making sure that there's oversight so that we know that, you know, our people's money is being spent well.
Okay, and then comment from Representative Hansen, and we are tight on time here, so if we could be quick.
I'll just go quick, Representative Hollins. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked on the floor so that we have the legislative intent here. The assets of the fund shall be appropriated by law for public purpose of protection, conservation, preservation, and enhancement of the state's air, water, land, fish, wildlife, and other natural resources. That's the constitutional language, and the community grant program would have to follow that language. Is that correct?
Representative Hollins.
That is correct.
Representative Hollins, any final comments?
Thank you, Chair Fisher, Chair Heintzman. Thank you, committee members. I hope that we can continue this conversation, and I hope you'll consider funding this very important project.
Thank you. With that, I move that House File 2218 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Next item on the agenda is House File 2293 be laid over for possible inclusion, and now we are going on to House File number 2218. Representative Faulkner, please step forward. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay, Representative Faulkner moves that House File 2218 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Faulkner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for taking the time to hear HF 2218, a bill investing in aquatic invasive species prevention and mitigation. For the duration of this, I will just refer to that as AIS, because that's a lot to say. As you know, aquatic invasive species is an ongoing problem that continues to plague our beautiful lakes. In the metro area alone, there's roughly 211 lakes infested with AIS. Zebra mussels, as one of the marquee examples, which can be found in 6 of the 7 counties, can cause mercury levels in perch to be up to 157% higher than perch from non-invaded lakes. Just one example. Lakes across the metro are affected by more than just the infamous zebra mussels, Eurasian milfoil, curly leaf pondweed, starry stonewort, to name a few plant species are choking out lakes, rivers, and waterways across the region. At least 5 different carp species, faucet snails, and water flea are examples of other animals out competing native fish species and bringing parasites to waterfowl as well as infecting humans. This is also good for the state's economy. The outdoor recreation industry in Minnesota generates $13.5 billion to the Minnesota economy, supporting over 96,000 jobs, and generates nearly $6 billion in wages every year. Everyone in this room today knows how much Minnesotans love to get outside and how much Minnesotans value our lakes and rivers. AIS can lead to a direct threat to large and small local businesses in addition to the threats to the ecology and human health. AIS has been shown to decrease property values, hitting homeowners and landowners as well as state and local property tax revenues. House File 2218 is a simple bill with a straightforward ask for $1.5 million from the General Fund to the Met Council for grants to the 10 metropolitan implementing agencies, keeping funding alive for the Metropark areas that we need to address AIS, not just for local residents, but Minnesotans statewide. As we all know, invasive species, by definition, do not stay in one specific area, thus the whole invasive part of their moniker. We need to continue to work to stop the spread and beat them back in infested areas. With that, I'd like to kick it over to the testifiers to tell you more about how this money will benefit the Metropolitan Park system and protect the spread statewide.
Okay, very good. We have about a minute and a half for each testifier. Starting off, I have Mr. Bo Carlson, Superintendent of District. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, thank you. My name is Bo Carlson. I'm the Superintendent of Three Rivers Park District. We're a special park agency, special park district. We represent suburban Hennepin County, and we are one of 10 implementing agencies and the Metropolitan Parks Regional System. We represent the seven counties of the seven-county metro area, as well as the cities of Bloomington, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. We were established in 1976 as part of the Metro Regional Parks Act to essentially establish the state parks of the metro area, and that's essentially what our system is. And while we were created as an entity in 1976, many of our parks predate that time period, some going as far back as the 1880s when you think of Minneapolis and St. Paul. In their annual or their larger systems as a whole. Our system represents about 55,000 acres of land. We see about 65 million visits per year for our system, system-wide. And most of our recreational opportunities, our parks and our park reserves are established on water bodies. That is an essential element of what we provide. And when you think of the infrastructure investment the state of Minnesota has made, the metro area has made in those parks, those park reserves, those recreation opportunities, and to see the degradation of those facilities because of AIS certainly is a travesty for the situation or for the state and for the metro area. So this bill is a small step in the right direction of trying to address some of those issues and continuing the inspection programs that we all as agencies are already doing and continue to support that. So with that, I'll turn it over to County Commissioner Mirren to talk a little bit more about this bill.
Okay. Thank you. County Commissioner Mirren. Welcome to the committee. It's great to see you again, sir. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. My name is Fran Mirren. I'm a Washington County Commissioner. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. The spreading of invasive species is a building concern of the people we serve. Impacts of AIS to lake ecology, recreational experiences, and the like are a significant issue. Big Carnet Alien Lake was recently found with zebra mussel infestation that was too wide to treat. And of the $10 million in funding in the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Aid Program, which started in 2014, Washington County receives about $134,000 annually. And this was leveraged, has been leveraged by $34,500 in local matches. In 2025, additional local matches are being sought. We're expecting to double what's currently being worked through for local funding matches. I want to draw your attention to this graph, which demonstrates, it's a bell curve, which demonstrates, should be in your packet, which demonstrates the impact of funding for AIS. The counties began receiving funding back in 2014. And you can see with the county's engagement that we've been able to lower the new AIS infestations in our lakes in Minnesota, and we appreciate that opportunity. The current governor's budget reduces the funding for all counties by 50% in this biennium, creating a reduction in the ability to control the spread of aquatic invasive species. Cuts in this program will jeopardize years of progress and makes the state more vulnerable to the costly and damaging impacts of AIS. Recent studies have linked zebra mussels to a dramatic increase in mercury loading in fish, exceeding consumption advisories. Splitting the funds up for lake treatments and inspections have proven beneficial, but many concerned residents noted that more is needed. We recently had former Senator Jane Krentz come before our board asking for additional funding and work by the county. The lakes in the regional park system are a major draw for recreational experiences for visitors from throughout the region and state. These are gateway experiences to lakes throughout the state for many individuals. They're part of what makes the regional park system so special. Individuals from throughout Minnesota come to experience recreation on the waters found within the regional park. And I'll draw your attention to the other map, which demonstrates the influx of boaters into Big Marine Park Reserve, which is part of the district that I serve. It's, I think, demonstrates the impact that the state is having on visits to our regional parks. So the additional $1.5 million is critical to our continued infrastructure and service on EIS, and we would appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, we will move on to questions for members. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that this is generally for the bill's author. And it's always difficult if I take an opposite position of my friend, Mr. Meyer, in there. Just kind of wanted to overlay this with the larger concern for our state's budget. You know, the governor's budget certainly addresses this. You mentioned that a moment ago. But, you know, why in this circumstance should we be looking at the counties in the metro comparison to the rest of the state? And I guess that's for the bill's author.
Representative Faulkner.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I think, to me, this really comes down to the fact that we have such a higher percentage or a higher visitation rate within the seven-county metro area, and a 50% cut across the board for every county disproportionately affects the counties that have some of the highest visitation in the state. And so supplementing some of the cuts to beef up the ability to fight the invasive species, mitigation, prevent, as well as then doing a lot of inspections so the boats leaving this county area and going out to greater Minnesota will also see the benefit of less spread.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Falconer, what would be your suggestion for greater Minnesota counties on this topic?
Representative Faulkner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I would be more than happy to co-author a bill if you wanted to bring one forward.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falconer, it sounds like you don't quite have a plan on what we should do for the other 80 counties of the state, which is, you know, something where, especially when we're considering this budget deficit that's been created because there's no money after having an $18 billion budget surplus. So just general concern for that, Mr. Chair, that we're cutting out seven counties in comparison to the whole. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Any further comments? Seeing none, Representative Faulkner. Any final comments?
Just thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for just considering this bill. House File 2218 is vital for the money needed to protect our lakes and recreation opportunities. An ounce of AIS prevention is worth a pound of lake treatment down the line. When both the economy and the environment can be helped, I hope that's something we can all agree on. Everybody on my side of the aisle knows I'm kind of a fan of haikus, so I'll end with one. Invasive species should not be in our waters. Pass 2218. All right. Thank you so much.
Representative Faulkner renews his motion that House File 2218 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. With that, we will switch out gavels, chairs here.
Representative Fisher will be making his way up to the dais. And Chair Fisher, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Chair Purcell, I would like to move that House File 1208 be laid over for possible inclusion for a future bill.
Chair Fisher, I believe you have an author's amendment you would like for us to consider as well.
Yes, I do, Chair Purcell. I'd like to move the A1 amendment. And may I go ahead and explain what I'm doing here?
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. First part of the amendment that I have, and this be lines 1.3 through 1.13, these are items that came as a result of of talks that I had had with a number of different tribes, several different tribes, when I was interacting with them back and forth about different things happening. We had original presentations on permitting, when the issues around the helium issue came through, where a number of the tribes were expressing frustration with the process that was out there, is that they weren't feeling they were meaningfully engaged. And one of the things that seemed to be a common thread that I was hearing is that often they felt too often they were getting a lot of information in the permitting process too late. They'd like to be able to get the information and permitting much easier earlier. So the language I have here is something that I had started working on a while ago. This is a work, this part of the language is a work in process, and continuing to hear input from different tribes and different agencies and different people on this. The second part of the amendment I have, which is line 1.14 going forward, this is an EQB provision that was originally my bill, House File 1204. I'm bringing it all together here so that the different permitting provisions that I have that were related to permitting, I could pull together all in one document as we're going forward. And basically what is happening here is that with the EQB, it's clarifying a language for who may submit petitions for any environmental assignment assessment worksheets, and it's basically adding in that petitions may be submitted by Minnesota tribal government as defined under section 10.65, or not less than 100 individuals who reside or own property in the state. And that is my A1. I would ask for support to get the bill in the shape I would prefer.
Chair Fisher moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like. Those all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Fisher, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. So the A1 amendment was a big part of that. The next part I'd like to turn over to my testifier here. These are provisions from the MPCA addressing notice requirements for wastewater treatment plants and looking for permitting efficiency.
Thank you. Please address the committee, and if you can keep your comments to about a minute and a half, we do have one more bill after this one. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and really quickly, I'll walk through the provisions of the bill. Do just want to quickly thank Chair Fisher for authoring House File 1208 for the MPCA, which is the governor's bill, and we support. As you heard earlier, there are other components to the permitting reform package within the governor's budget recommendations. These are the peer policy provisions in the underlying 1208. So Section 1 applies only to municipal water treatment facilities or publicly owned treatment works, and allows non-controversial permits to be granted a 30-day comment period instead of a 60-day comment period if requested by the permittee. Often these municipal permits have state funds through the Public Facilities Authority or otherwise publicly funded, and the city has often created an opportunity for public feedback at the local level already, and so this is just a reduction of 60 to 30 days would only be granted if there is now no significant interest in the permit. Section 2 provides for shared accountability between the agency and the permit applicant. After a permit is deemed administratively complete, the MPCA starts its technical review. During that review, we often require additional information from the applicant. While the MPCA understands and accepts accountability for our timeliness in working on permits, we believe the agency should not be held accountable for situations where we are waiting for days or weeks or months for information we have requested from a permit applicant. As the MPCA has continued to benchmark ourselves with other states at the encouragement of the Minnesota Chamber and other stakeholders, this was a tool we saw working in other states. Section 3 of the bill, of the underlying bill, Section 4, I believe, of the amended bill, provides clarity for permit applicants to quickly understand the MPCA's authorities to require air dispersion modeling. The MPCA has broad authority under the Federal Clean Air Act, Minnesota statutes 116.06, as well as other state statutes, and also Minnesota rules 7007. A few of those rules, 707.0800, 707.0100, et cetera, I won't mention them all, Madam Chair, but these sections are the MPCA's authority to ensure that permits that we are issuing that the facility is able to meet the National Ambient Air Quality Standards or the Minnesota Ambient Air Quality Standards. And so while those authorities are broad and not specific, that's where we get challenges to that authority, and that can add a lot of time to permit applications. Again, days, weeks, months, where we're being challenged on our authority, even though we have it in several different places. So we're looking to create a specific place in statute where we can point to provide transparency to permit applicants to make sure that process is moving along quickly. Just quickly to the amendment, Madam Chair, just want to say I really appreciate the efficiency in getting the EQB policy bill on here as well. And we do support that bill as the putting on my EQB hat here. Nothing has changed in the relation to the requirement that the petition be submitted with material evidence that shows potential for the significant environmental effects. The change in Section 5 recognizes the sovereignty of tribal governments and ensure that there is that direct option for the government to submit a petition on behalf of their citizens. So nothing changing to the requirements, just recognizing that tribal sovereignty. As Chair Fisher mentioned, we do have some concerns that we've communicated on the new Section 3 in the amendment, mostly logistical concerns. And so we're working with the chair on that, but we appreciate the intent of the bill, and certainly the agency is committed to continuing to engage early and often with tribal governments in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The next testifier I have on my list is Andrew Morley, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Please attempt to keep your comments to about 90 seconds, Mr. Morley, and introduce yourself for the record.
All right. Co-Chair Heitzman and Co-Chair Fisher, my name is Andrew Morley, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Our membership includes more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes from every industry across the state and their 500,000 employees. The Chamber and our broader permitting reform coalition seek certainty, transparency, and fewer costs passed on to consumers. HF 8, heard in this body earlier this session, does just that, and we support that legislation. However, we at the Chamber appreciate Co-Chair Fisher and the MPCA's continued engagement on efforts to update Minnesota's permitting process. While we may disagree on a few provisions here and there, we look forward to constructive dialogue at this meeting and into the near future. My testimony today will be dedicated to Sections 2 and 3 of the bill, along with the A1 amendment. Co-Chair Fisher, thank you for including in Section 2 an effort to revise the process where the agency asks applications for further technical information after the application is deemed administratively complete. As has been said in this committee before, Minnesota is an outlier in permitting review times, as it can take up to 6 times longer than comparable states. Rarely does the agency complete applications for Tier 2 air permits within the goals set in statute. This provision would let the agency stop the clock and help with reporting statistics while sending the applicant back with further requests for information that must be turned around within 30 days. While the language allows for an extension, this time frame asks for a narrow window to conduct potentially costly site tests that need to align scheduling with contractors, designing models, and more. Co-Chair Fisher, we believe the conversation we're having now on your Section 2 is better suited for addressing application completeness reviews as opposed to post-completeness technical reviews. If we buttoned up the completeness process, the problems that may arise during the technical review would already be anticipated by the applicant. Sure thing. Section 3 of the bill gives the MPCA new authority to require further air dispersion modeling. We sent a letter at the end of January on this exact topic and requested where the statutory authority was. We haven't heard back, and we see this may be the answer. Really quickly on the A1, we certainly appreciate the intent. We have a question about what the definition of substantial direct effect is, and we think that can be better defined in the bill. As it stands right now, the A1 also allows federally recognized tribal governments in Minnesota to petition for discretionary EAW. Under current law, any individual who resides in the state can petition for discretionary EAW with 100 signatures. Therefore, those tribal government people that live in the state can already do such a thing.
Thank you, Mr. Morley. We still have another bill to get to after this, so I'm going to have you conclude your testimony. And our next testifier, Darren Broughton, please approach the stand.
Thank you, Chair Fisher.
Thank you. And attempt to keep your comments to a minute and a half. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair members. My name is Darren Broughton, the Executive Director of Minnesota AgriGrowth. I want to thank Chair Fisher and the MPCA for House File 1208. there's some really important improvements here in this bill. I'll just call it a couple. Section 1 adds a lot more flexibility for municipal wastewater treatment plant permits, and that's extremely helpful because many parts of the state, as we look to build and improve wastewater, or excuse me, food processing facilities, there's usually a point where improvements or changes need to be made in those local municipal wastewater treatment plants. And so this flexibility provides an opportunity to provide that flexibility to synchronize those permits for important economic development projects. I also want to highlight Section 2 in that accountability is always a two-way street. And Section 2 provides more accountability in the permitting process. We're setting a clear new deadline for permit applicants to submit additional information to the agency. Section 2 could be further improved, though, by setting a clear deadline for the agency to determine when additional information is required to complete that permit. This could prevent a drip strategy where the agency continues numerous requests throughout the permitting process, causing further delays. AgriGrowth recognizes that there are competing ideas on how to improve and streamline the state's permitting process. There seems to be universal agreement, though, that the status quo is not working for communities, not working for farmers, and not working for job creators. Permitting reform has become too partisan and too political. Voters don't care about permitting reform. They do care about jobs and the economy, and let's make meaningful reform happen this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Broughton. Anyone from the audience who cares to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will close that portion of testimony and go to member questions. Co-Chair Hansman, would you like to go first or would you like to follow Representative Schultz?
I'll go.
Co-Chair Hansman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions will probably end up being for the director. So I'm seeing a number of letters in our member packet. There's one specifically from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. And I think what we're centering around in the concern that's being created or voiced there is in Section 3, starting on lines 6.19 through 6.22. And so that's where I was going to quickly just check. They're mentioning that there is some things that they like, but with the Greater Minnesota Cities, they're pointing out that they're concerned about this, about such language. It will be relied upon by MPCA to place undue burdens on municipality-owned utilities. And a similar comment made by the MMUA with concern that it would be authorizing MPCA to require modeling as provided in Section 3 under this House File 1208 to increase costs and impose an undue hardship on municipal utilities. Again, I am just wondering what MPCA's response is to that, and then I have, I think, one more.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To be clear, the MPCA's policies on when to require modeling are not changing here. We already require modeling in many different situations. And in fact, we just published new guidance on when modeling is required. So that should be very clear when that's required and when that's not required. What this is doing is just creating a clear spot in statute where, it's very abundantly clear for permit applicants what the underlying authority is. We can list five different rules and three statutes that are apply, but this is a lot cleaner.
Thank you, Chair Heisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that answer, but I'm trying to understand, you're saying that this doesn't change anything, if I'm hearing you correctly, that it's already in statute, then why are these folks concerned? And then also, overall, this bill and this section specifically, why do we believe that what's going on in the language here, how will it lead to efficiency in permitting?
And then a follow-up comment, and I'll be done.
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I think there is a lot of interest and concern at times with the requirements for modeling. And so I think what we see a lot of the time is a challenge to the MPCA's authority when we're ensuring that a permit applicant's facility is going to be able to comply with the federal or state air quality standards. So because the authority is dispersed among several different rules and statutes and is broad, like just the authority to look at or to ensure the compliance with national air quality standards, that authority is often challenged. And so what we're saying here is that can be a significant delay. We have seen those conversations, that back and forth, take, again, days, weeks, months. And so having a clear spot where this is abundantly clear in statute will make sure those conversations are much shorter, Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to be quick. I know we're close on time. I think that the important takeaway from today's hearing, Chair Fisher, and to those in attendance today, is that literally everybody recognizes that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And from the governor's office to the GOP to the DFL, we're all looking at the timelines that were shown to us in the Barr engineering report that's been referenced now to for many, many months, almost a year, as being uncompetitive when you look at surrounding states. And similar states in geography and similar states in political sort of makeup. And many states are far more competitive than Minnesota, and these are not states, you know, that would ever be considered to be red states necessarily. There's a lot of blue states that are doing a better job at permitting than Minnesota is. And I think that all of us talking about this issue is a positive step. I hope that in the end that we're all coming together and finding solutions that work for stakeholders and for people. I think that it's important to note as we finish, at least I'm going to finish my comments in this way, that nobody, not on the DFL side, not on the Republican side, are suggesting that we lower standards. And I think that's really important for people to take note of, and that we're looking for efficiency wherever it can be found, but not at the cost of health. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for your bill. As I'm looking at it, there's a lot to digest here, in some ways very good for us to digest. And frankly, I'm a little bit bummed that we didn't have that time in January to be more thorough when we could have all been around this table. And I feel a little bit pressed for time on where, and I know we're laying this bill over, but the contents of this bill deserve to be discussed more. Can you, Mr. Chair, can you kind of outline what this bill does as it relates to tribal governments and either just kind of highlight those details of what this bill does so that we have a better understanding?
Thank you. Chair Fisher, perhaps you can address that question and do your final wrap-up comments.
I could
throw it to you.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. So what this bill does is makes it clear that in terms of tribal sovereignty that they will be able to have the opportunity to do petitioning when they feel it's important for their tribal areas. The new section that I added in is very important, is to make sure that we're engaging the tribal community in meaningful consultation beforehand, because one of the things I heard very clearly by reading the comments they submitted under the Helium proposal, by hearing their comments back on the House File 8, they are extremely disappointed. The ones that talked to me, these are not all of them, but the ones that have talked to me, are extremely frustrated that they are not being engaged in a meaningful way in the consultation process in areas that have pollution impacts onto their tribal land and their treaty lands. And we have a responsibility to make sure that we're following up on those. And we've done as a state, while we've made improvements, we still have a long way to go, and it's important that we continue working those areas. With that, I'd like to say that it's important that we come together and figure out the proper way to address what is happening in permitting. While we've heard the bar engineering report referred to and the chamber referred to it, one of the things to remember in the time delays out there is that part of the things that they're counting in there are the delays that are happening because there are bad actors out there, and those bad actors are part of the reason that we had delays out there. I know that none of us want to have the bad actors out there and that we're working together to find it. We also want to make sure that we're getting to the root cause of the problem, because this is not the first time or the second time or the third time we're looking at permitting efficiency over the last many years that I've been here. And I want to make sure we're getting the right problem solved as we go forward. And it might, you know, I'm committed to continuing to work on it and realize that there may be some problems that are going to need further analysis that may require us to come back and continue looking at to make sure we're getting the right answers. Thank you.
Chair Fisher renews his motion that House File 1208 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. I'm going to let Chair Fisher come back up here to make the call since we are over time.
Very quickly, I see we have Representative Heintzman up at the table there. Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, two-year bill, House File 1482.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would move House File 1482 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and I would incorporate on page 19, line 7, deleting Bay West LLC and inserting Freshwater Society. Correction that Ms. Taylor does have.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read page 19, line 7, delete Bay West, LLC, and insert Freshwater Society.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. And if I could ask a clarifying, would this be the same correction, technical correction that was made to the bill that Representative Heintzman had that was similar to this?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, very good. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested.
Bill itself, Mr. Chair.
On the bill, but not the amendment.
Correct.
Okay, so let's deal with the amendment first. All in favor of the technical amendment as stated, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved. So to House File 1482 as amended. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the same bill that had been heard earlier. This is a clean version of the LCCMR recommendations. Earlier this afternoon, we heard the community grant program, and we, you know, I think that is a different path that has been tied on to the bill that left here earlier. This would be a clean bill that could move forward. I would change my motion, if the roll call is dropped, to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Chair Heintzman.
Mr. Chair, if the motion is to lay the bill over, I would withdraw my roll call.
Okay, the motion then is changed. Instead of being referred to Ways and Means, we will be laying it over.
As amended.
Any, first of all, I should also say, while we had no testifiers signed up, is there anyone in the public who'd like to testify? Hearing none, are there any further comments, questions? Hearing none, Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
This is a clean bill that would be laid over for possible inclusion, or it could move out separately.
Okay, thank you. With that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1482 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. With that, we are adjourned.